I want to center this. I want you to imagine that I am a 14-year-old girl.
Right.
My name is Olivia.
Right.
I've got no idea what you do.
Right.
So can you explain to me, as a 14-year-old girl, what it is that you do?
I do, Olivia. I do.
You do.
Because of Ollie, because it. Yeah,
exactly.
Got it. I do. I'm the publisher of a media brand called Monocle, which is a magazine company that has evolved into being a cross-platform media brand. Podcasts, radio, books, retail. At the core of it is still a beautifully crafted print magazine. And I am the publisher of that, which means, in this context, that I run the team that sells all of the advertising and partnerships for it.
Perfect.
Yeah.
I feel like I know now what you do.
Okay.
Not just as Olivia, but also as Ollie.
Also as you. Yeah. Fair enough.
Okay, and I want to ask kind of, this is a how did you get there kind of question. But if you were to point to one thing in your career that sped up your career, what would that one thing be?
I think it's a case of curiosity and following the doors that open and just being like, hold on, that looks really interesting. I'm really interested in that. I should speak to that person. I should try this. I should go after this. I think in general terms, before I talk about the plethora of failures of my early 20s, but like, I think generally curiosity and being like, that looks cool. Why don't I go and speak to that person? Why don't I go and apply for that thing? Sod it. Doesn't matter if I don't know what it is or if I can do it.
I'm getting this like okayness with failing there as well.
Yes.
Which I feel like people need to hear more about. Mm. Like the feeling of, I might get this wrong. They might not reply to my message, and that's absolutely fine. Love that. Mm. Money, icky question. Rank question, but I need to ask you the question.
Mm.
What does somebody at the top of their game earn in what you do?
I can't tell you, but what I can tell you is that there are two other Lukes in me. We have this thing. I sometimes get written to. There's a Luke at the FT, and there's a Luke who was at Condé Nast, and now I think is at Hyson Piety.
Mm.
And I look at those two Lukes, and I wonder. And I would try and get them in a room and ask them that same question. In fact, my intent would be to get one of those Lukes. I mean, one I think the FT one lives in Dubai. But to get one of those media Lukes in on this podcast and for you to ask him the same question and then quickly just send me the answer.
And then you can,
and then we rewind to now and then I answer something that's like punchier.
Fair. Okay, that's good. That's fair enough. Okay, I want to get into the depth of what you actually do here. Mm. So these are my warm up / deep dives. Mm. What brought you into publishing and what keeps you motivated at Monocle?
I think what brought me into publishing, I applied for the job as a project manager or creative solutions manager and got really into the fact that then I think media for this kind of platform was changing. About 10 years ago, it was traditional display, print display advertising. You'd talk to a client and sell 10 DPSs across the whole year. And I went in as a creative solutions project manager, and that was essentially working on advertorial. So working on paid for content that took the editorial ambition, the editorial voice, the creative voice of the magazine and brought it into essentially creating better work for clients in some cases than their campaigns were. And that was really fascinating. And I think in my first week, I was working on a project for Audi, for the government of Thailand, for the government of Japan, for Chanel. And I went, this is nuts. Mm. This is so fascinating. And I'm kind of answering what brought me in. Yes, kind of that route, I guess.
Mm.
And then what, even from that first week, just being like the exposure to this many clients and this many differing needs that you're essentially using one point of view or one platform, one aesthetic voice, one creative voice, one editorial voice to sort of go, okay, how do I leverage that, e.g. Monocle and what it stands for, in order to solve a comms challenge, a marketing challenge for a client.
Ooh, I love that.
I got an ooh out of you.
Yeah, that's the thing that keeps, that's an infinite game.
That's an infinite game. I think there's a logic, there's a sort of emotional logic puzzle in that.
Yeah.
That sort of keeps you going. And I went through the project managing side of it to really sort of understand how do you work? How do you also work with a team who have to produce a beautiful magazine each month and say, by the way, I know that's your client, but also Sansiri are your client. Breitling are your client, Omega are your client, and how do you diplomatically juggle that and get your best work out of that team? Because the one thing that's always really interesting is that we don't farm off commercial content to just another studio. We do it internally. So that's quite fun. The logic puzzle's bloody tricky though, but it's compelling enough to keep one there in a way that I think if I hadn't been an interloper and joined media relatively sort of midway through my career, I think if I was working this 10 years ago, if I was working this in the golden age of Condé Nast, a la Graydon Carter, selling $100,000 pages in Vanity Fair, I would just be so rich I wouldn't mind. But I think now the logic puzzle of the notion and the art of selling content and experiential and leveraging a voice and a platform like this for a client is really, it's cool. It's really interesting.
I love that. How do Monocle and Confect differ in their approach?
So two things. Confect grew out of Monocle and really was a sense of we launched it in a mad time to launch any magazine, but a great time as well in terms of audience. We launched it in Q4 of 2020. We launched it on the basis that I think creatively there's a sense that Monocle, there's so much that is shot for the magazine in terms of palazzos and residences and hospitality. What if you had a bit more breathing space? What if you could take some of that amazing film photography and just really lean into travel, to hospitality, to style, and be a bit longer form, be a bit less behind the curtain, and maybe give that incredible house in Venice, four spreads, full bleed. Well, maybe you could do something like that. And I think we also realized, although our chairman realized, that there was, as Confect is predominantly female orientated in target, but that there was a woman who's like 35 plus who maybe the great shift in a lot of the other media players to a much younger Gen X audience, celeb covers, etc. Maybe that was no longer servicing a profile who might have read Vogue back in the day, or who might have read Harper. I mean, Harper's they're probably still reading, so fine. But there was a shift in terms of, okay, is the traditional newsstand still serving that target, or is there something a little bit more refined that we can target? And then obviously Monocle's Monocle, and you know, it is what it is, and it's had that incredible relationship built up, incredible reputation built up. But I would say that's the difference. Confect is a newer product, but it does something different. It does something interestingly complementary in that we would work with partners across both to achieve slightly different aims.
Fair. It sounds like deeper and demographically more aligned.
I would say,
as they splinter?
I would say that it's... The demographic skews a little bit more female in the way that Monocle's 70-30 in favour of male.
Yeah, okay.
Confect goes the other way. And then I think in terms of what it talks about, it goes more into those territories.
What is a brand partnership that you have been managing that you feel would immortalise you?
God, to be immortalised by partnership content, I think is a lofty... It's a no.
I'll change my question.
No, I want it. I'm actually. I'm going to talk to a couple of them. I to be immortalized by this, I think is amazing. I think, look, last year we worked with Gucci in a really interesting way, and in a way that I think pushed what we maybe had done in the brand partnership space, but we created a guide to London for their cruise show. And that guide to London was done. I mean, it was a mad endeavor in the sense that it was take a color reference of Ancora Rosso from a shopping bag and work out how to map that onto the cover of an incredible book that we were going to make for them. 17 color tests later, so many inks tried, but we got it. And that became something that went in the invitation to their cruise show to all of the attendees. And then we did a complete takeover of the cafe on Chilton Street, the Monocle Cafe on Chilton Street, and we had an Ancora Rosso awning, we had vinyls, we had a photo exhibition from everything that we shot in a four-week production space for this guide on the walls. And we gave away a copy of the guide with everyone who bought a copy of the magazine and a coffee, the first like 50 people each morning. And that was quite interesting in terms of there was some media. I mean, they had their campaign running with us. They had some. They bought some digital media on our newsletter. But that was a really interesting partnership in terms of just how many areas it touched. And then most recently, we did a very similar thing with Massimo Dutti in terms of creating broadsheets, Kath Massimo in residence at the Monocle Cafe, Chilton Street, us in residence at their flagship. And I thought, this is really interesting in the way that it changes the way that media like us work with brands.
Yeah.
So am I immortalized by it many, many years later, as suddenly everyone does cafe takeovers and beautiful bespoke publications? Maybe, but...
This is true. Maybe imitation is immortalization.
But I think that's it. And then the very same way, we've had a really fantastic relationship with the Department of Culture and Tourism in Abu Dhabi at the same time, in the same breath, that's been really about articulating the way in which they invest in culture through Saadiyat Island, through a whole plethora of initiatives that they've done for the city, and us just taking that, putting it through our lens and putting it into the kind of conversation with our audience that you would expect of the title.
Do you think there's a flood of interest or, you know, investment from brands into experiential more than there was 10 years ago? Because the resources to do an experiential event are the same as they've always been. But my hunch is that we have a digital fatigue. You know, when the whole Web3 thing was kicking off and, you know, have a whatever thing here, a cryptocurrency thing here. Oh my God, turn it off. I just want to be in a thing, experiencing the thing with my hands and my eyes and my nose. Am I right in my hunch that I feel like there's more of an appetite from brands and more of an appetite from consumers to be physically experiencing brands?
I mean, I think so. I think there are two things that have happened. I think, and I say this, you know, I work for an analog brand. I mean, we have a new .com we launched, we have digital practice, but the notion of success being a digital transformation path is for us not true. A digital optimization path, yeah. I think there was an interesting moment, maybe when I, like before I started, where you almost had to justify why you were doing what you were doing against why shouldn't spend be on a pure digital platform, given the reach. I think there was another thing that, you know, you'll hear the likes of Tina Brown talk about, which was the fact that suddenly all of these mass digital platforms came along and said to traditional media platforms, look, give us all your content and we'll give you a ton of impressions. And so everyone did. And then the monetization of those impressions were, well, the platforms, Meta, etc., they took the revenues from that, and the publishers were left with this commodity of impressions. But what do you do with it?
Yeah.
What do you actually do with it? And so I think one can go down that path philosophically, but I think now I find that we're not telling a client, look, you should, it's an either or in terms of print and in world versus digital. I think we are so sophisticated as media consumers. We are two speed. We consume quickly on digital platforms, but we consume slowly in print and in world and in analog platforms. We do both. And we set aside specific time for both. And yes, I think there is a hyper-digital fatigue. I think there is also a really interesting time now in terms of we're coming again in a world where there is an unbounded plethora of choice as a consumer. Mm. I think we're coming back to valuing the notion of the curator, of the editor, in that something is given to you, whether or not that's an in-world platform, a digital platform, but it is the specific curated point of view of an individual.
I fucking love that, because we are in knowledge overload. Mm. Albert Einstein said, imagination beats knowledge every time. We have all the knowledge. Now I need someone to filter that knowledge, someone that I admire, someone whose taste I want to hear and get something from. See, I totally agree with you. Curation is going to be so important now.
And why does that then play into print? Why are we still, I mean, I think 5 years ago, McKinsey would have said to a business like ours, what on earth are you still doing? I mean, you, there's no way you can still exist. And the fact that it does more than still exist. And that so many others, I mean, you go to a newsstand like Shriji News on Chilton Street, you go to the newsstands we run in Paris, etc., and you'll see new titles. You'll see that the Le Monde just launched Le Monde International. You'll see that there are a plethora of new, the ID we launched, etc. There are a plethora of new expensive to produce print titles. Why is that? And I think that speaks to that. I think it also speaks to we have come to value the commodity of our attention much more as consumers as well, in terms of okay, I actually need now to spend time in a way that is slow, that is like where things are served to me in a way where there's care and consideration, and nothing is distracting me. And I think that speaks to why is the magazine expensive to buy? We shoot everything on film. We work with some of the highest grade paper from some of the best mills in the world. That product now is a luxury. And I think there was another interesting thing in terms of the space that magazines used to occupy. Maybe this is because I'm saying this because I've just finished Graydon Carter's new book, but magazines used to occupy a position of mass media. You watch Friends, whenever anyone's bored, they're picking up a magazine and flicking through, whereas now you pick up your phone. Magazines no longer occupy that space, and that is fine. But they occupy, the ones that survive and thrive occupy a really interesting, really different space. But it's just not the mass anymore.
I love this. You've really converted me on the idea of magazines.
Like, good. I think that's kind of my
I'm going to buy Men's
job.
Health when I get to the shop. This is a ChatGPT-based question.
Go on.
I want to know, number one, what is the weirdest thing that you've used ChatGPT for?
Do you know what? I've just started using it.
Okay.
And the only thing, is it weird to map paint colours onto a room and to see what Farrow and Ball railings looks like in a, like, an inappropriate use of Mylands or Farrow and Ball for a living room? That's where I've got, is that weird? I don't know.
I think it's perfect.
I think it's
perfect.
I mean, I also used it to add up some numbers to put into a report, but that feels very pedestrian.
Okay, tick. Number two, and I think you'll be brilliant for this one, industry jargon that you want to put in the bin.
We have so many acronyms, our side. And actually, the problem with putting jargon in the bin is that occupying and inheriting and using jargon frequently initially gives you that dopamine hit of feeling incredibly intelligent. And I'd never want to lose that feeling. So I want to keep all the acronyms, deploy them as I learn them. Only yesterday did I realize I was using one of them wrong in quite a humiliating way. But now, what I've now done, I won't name the acronym because it will look terrible, but what I've now done is I've now taken that acronym and I use it every day. So, for example, TLDR.
Yeah.
So I will later on say, oh yeah, yeah, great email, TLDR, but like, get the gist.
Yeah, get the gist.
And I will use that.
You're
I will welcome. Use it 10 times.
You're so welcome. That's a good one. TLDR. Like, oh, you know what?
No, like it.
Last question. Beautiful question. What is the slogan of Luke Courtier's life?
I think it's tricky. I mean, one part of me talks of fail upward, but one part of me also thinks that the notion of are you curious about something? Because if you're curious, I think there's this great driver of curiosity as it pertains to attention, as it pertains to drive, as it pertains to, like, I think if you stop being curious, you stop running at things, and you stop. And I think with curiosity, so how do you, ChatGPT will make this a slogan in a way that I can't.
We've got fail upwards and then...
Fail upwards and then there's a curiosity thing.
Curiosity killed the cat.
And then I could be really wanky and do the E.M. Forster always connect quote.
Do it.
So, I mean, always connect is an E.M. Forster quote that I think is quite good.
What does that mean to you when you say always connect?
Always pick up the phone, always find the person, always like ask why, always like go to the thing, say yes to the thing, explore the opportunity, get to know, like find a connection interpersonally, and then I think find a connection through the work and through what you're doing.
I love that. I like always connect. There's particularly because it's rare to get a slogan that's two words. You have to really know and appreciate language if you can do two words.
It belongs to E.M. Forster, who wrote A Room with a View. So
no,
I should
it's Luke Courtier from now on. This will go on your tombstone.